Coming up on Voice of Youth, where every week we take a different term of teen slang,
crib,
smack,
WTF,
kingpin,
hood,
and define it as only youth can. This week, our first imported term of teen slang, daytime. What is the daytime?
It's a party that people have during the daytime.
And where is it from?
Chicago.
In this next hour, a veteran truant officer shares the counseling he's offered parents with truant kids.
Lock the door. Don't let him in.
A comparative education professor in Hong Kong explains that he, too, has trouble keeping track of his kid.
Late at night, we call her up and say, please come home now.
And last but definitely not least, legendary education critic Jonathan Kozol explains he has some critics of his own.
My mom, she looked at it and she said, you're going across America with that?
And of course, our hosts give you an earful of sagas and situations, questions and comments, all about this Chicago teen slang term, daytime. Hosts, 3, 2, 1, take it away.
I'm host, LaQuetta Simmons. Amanda Wells and I first encountered the word daytime when we visited Chicago for a conference in October. We decided then it would be our first foreign term of slang we would take up to try and understand. Since then, we've been on a winding, twisting journey to understand this word. You're about to join that journey.
This is host Amanda Wells, wishing you a very warm welcome to the somewhat sinister world of daytime that you're about to enter for an hour. Daytime is a word for something that doesn't even exist around here. Basically a party you have when you ditch school, which makes it a bad thing for teens to do, right? We had people saying, well, I hope you aren't giving teens around here any ideas. And a whole host of issues came up when we questioned whether you could say that ditching school was a bad thing or not.
A lot of times, school is the most dangerous place to be. For example, I remember one year me and my brother had to go to this high school out here for summer school. And it just so happened that at this time, they had made all the summer schools at one school. So even if you didn't like somebody from a certain school, it didn't matter because you guys all had to go to the same school for summer school. And it just so happened that this summer, summer school was being held at our rival high school, and we had a lot of enemies there, so to speak, me, my brothers, and our friends. And so anyways, one morning we're going to summer school, me and my brother on the bus. We go to this park, we get off the bus, and I see people in the parking lot, and I told my brother it doesn't look like a good idea to get off the bus. He said, you know, who cares, let's just get off the bus anyways. So we got off the bus immediately. As soon as we got off the bus, we heard a lot of people screaming, hey, get him, get him, get him. And noticed immediately that it was our enemies, so a lot of them started running towards us. By now, me and my brother took off running through the park. Some of them took off running after us. Some of them got in their cars and tried to drive around and block us off at the other end. So anyways, I told my brother to just go because a lot of them started coming, so I just wanted him to be safe. So he took off running to school, and eventually I met up with my brother.
A lot of times, school is the place that makes you feel the most worthless. For example, this one time at my high school, a really good friend of mine, Jonathan Field, had died, committed suicide. And the same week, there's a rally, a winter rally that's supposed to showcase the arts. And they wouldn't let us have a moment of silence for Jonathan. Me and my friend went up to talk to our principal, and he was like, well, rallies are supposed to be fun, and not everyone knew him, so we can't say anything about him. When I heard this, I just did not want to be at school that day. I didn't even go to the rest of my two classes because I felt like the principal wasn't honoring the way that I felt or even Jonathan as a person if we couldn't even say anything about him at a school-wide event, which makes me feel that none of us are respected at our school, and why should we be at a place or an establishment that doesn't respect us as human beings?
But don't just take our word for the attitudes that kids have about school. We present to you as a bit more proof some rather quirky essays written by the anonymous story staff of Voice of Youth.
They were asked to tell us if they ditch school, what happens when they do.
Roll it, as they say.
I hardly ever ditch school. You can't get away with it at the school I'm at now. They call your parents at work. It's not a voice machine where you can go home and delete the message from school. But at my old school, Rancho Cotati, well, it was a lot bigger, and you could get away with a lot. The most memorable time I ditched school was the day we set fire to the creek. One morning, when me and two of my friends met up before school, we planned that we were going to ditch our second period class. We hated our second period class because we felt our teacher was prejudiced. We felt she discriminated against kids who were goths, or at least people who looked different from her, the teacher. My friend Amanda would dress in black, have extreme makeup, wear chains, and our teacher would do everything she could to make Amanda miserable. For example, once Amanda was a little late, and the teacher asked her a question about something we had been talking about before Amanda got there. And Amanda was confused, and the teacher said, "Well, if you were here, you would know." Then Amanda had to write an essay about why she was late. Other people would be late all the time, and she would just give them a detention, but no humiliation. So anyway, that day, we had made a plan. We were going to hide in the creek during the passing period. And so we did. And it was really early in the morning, and it was cold. And so, as the pyro that I am, I started lighting stuff on fire with my lighter. I also gave the idea to start a bonfire to keep warm, and so we did, using all the old papers we didn't need, and then I tried lighting the dry creek bed on fire, but that didn't work so well. You have to understand that the creek is known for a lot of bad stuff to happen in or at it, like rape, death, drinking, drugs. You always read in the paper that something happened at the creek. There's beer bottles, alcohol bottles everywhere. There's always evidence of someone trying to run away, their stuff strewn out as if they'd been forced to flee. There's always a lot of clothes. So I found a pile of girl clothes, ripped like they'd been torn off, and poking with a stick, I found a pair of underwear. I used a stick to pick it up. It was white underwear, but it was all dirty and gross. Me being stupid, I was like, "Are they flammable?" And without thinking, I lit the underwear on fire. There was a whoosh and a blaze. I stood stuck looking at it. I was kind of like, whoa. My friends were hella tripping and also saying, "Oh, cool." And then they said, "Add it to the fire." So I did, and that's when we heard some people walking, and I didn't know what to do. And my friend said, "Put out the fire." But I threw the underwear into the creek instead and froze while the people walked past, not even noticing us. And then we went back on campus around lunchtime. So from that day, we called the experience the Day of the Flaming Panties. I never got caught or in trouble. I always got away with it. Every day I ditched, a different story.
I've never been to a daytime, as they say in Chicago, but I have ditched school, that's for sure. One of my favorite memories of ditching is one time when I was living in Las Vegas. I guess it's a favorite mostly because I didn't get caught. I've had better days of ditching, but I got caught those times. In Las Vegas, I never got caught because my school was so big, and plus, I was new, so they couldn't keep track of me. I lived in Las Vegas when I was 11 years old. My dad lived in Vegas, so I moved in with him. My sister and I thought it sounded fun to live there, and we were all set to be there for a while. We had to leave after 3 months when my dad lost his job, but that's another story. Back to the day of ditching, in Las Vegas, I had a hella long bike ride to school. The trip took about 45 minutes. I would ride away from the houses, through a gas station and a small casino, then down a really steep hill, past apartment complexes. You could go fast, but you couldn't ride on the sidewalk, because there's trash cans, and I had learned the hard way about that when I ran into one of them and ended up bleeding and lying on the ground. There was a light at the bottom of the hill, and that day, like every day, it was green light, and I coasted through, got to the bottom, and met up with Zach, a kid from my school I'd never even talked to, who also was on his bike. As we turned onto the next road, I asked Zach if he was going to school, since he didn't have a backpack. But he did have a 7-Up, which was really bomb because of what was about to happen. He said, "No, I'm gonna go hang out in the desert, cause that's where our school was next to, and that was the place to be. There were always old bottles of liquor and stuff in the desert hills around my school. School to me was boring. I got in trouble, I was kind of lost because I just moved, there's confusing paperwork involved, and there were all these hoity-toity fancy people, and I was hella poor, and plus their mascot was the Knights, and that's kind of weird. I'd always had animal mascots." So I said, "Yeah, let's go." And he said, "I know of a place where we could go in the shade," which was awesome because it was like 500 degrees out. There was a big hill behind the school, and we jumped the fence, threw our bikes over the fence, hiding until school started, and the bell rang and it was safe to move around. And then we pushed our bikes into the desert. The sky was blue, the ground was brown and dusty, the temperature was really hot, and I was really thirsty. Right away, we saw these three girls, and they called us over. "Come here, do you want to ditch with us?" they said. They were 14, 15, and 13. And there's something weird about them. I don't know what it was. A few of them were wearing nasty makeup, and one of them was wearing contacts that were cat eyes. We walked with the girls till we found some shade. Then they got out a bottle of vodka and they drank out of the bottle, except for me. It was a little early for me since it was about 8 a.m. after all. So this was when the 7-Up was super bomb, because I was so thirsty at this point. After hours of random conversation, when we heard the bell that school was over, Zach and I left to his house and played video games, racing games. Then Zach's dad came home early, and he just walked in his room, but I was hiding by the closet, so he didn't see me. I jumped out of the window, called my dad, and asked him to come pick me up over at the high school. My dad came to get me and never found out that I ditched.
That was the story writing staff of Voice of Youth telling you more than you needed to know, perhaps, about what kids are doing when they're not at school.
I heard a lot of anger with teachers, a sense of feeling lost, a need for excitement.
But we felt like we still didn't know enough about the context of the word daytime. Marina Shapiro, Gabe Mort, and Danielle Yanigas got on the line with Nick, Voice of Youth correspondent in Chi-Town, who had a lot to say about the local tradition of daytimes and the universal phenomenon of cutting class.
Hello.
Hello, I'm Marina, and I'm here in the studio with Gabe and Daniela. You guys say hi.
What's up?
Say your names so you can identify your voice.
I'm Gabe. What's up?
I'm Daniela.
And we're on the line with Nick Bloomberg, right?
Uh-huh.
Who is about 2,000 miles away in Chicago. Nick, can you describe for us exactly where you are, your surroundings, like what you see, what you smell, and the vibe around you?
Right now I am in my room, which is nice and warm. But outside, there are 6 inches of snow on the ground, and it's windy and cold and disgusting.
Well, we've heard this word daytime. What's your definition of a daytime?
The definition of a daytime that I've heard used most often is that it's a party that people have during the daytime, when, you know, usually during school. You can drink and smoke up and get on or whatever. But sort of the excitement of ditching school and going to somebody's house and having a party.
Or you sort of, like, invited, or...
It would definitely be invite only.
Well, can I ask you, have you ever been invited to a daytime?
Or... I have. I never really... Like, I wouldn't say that I've been to one. I've been to one for maybe 5 minutes. And I was just like, look, this is a little bit intense for me. And I've been invited... But for me, it just feels like...
It's almost too sketch?
Yeah. Like, it's a little bit shady to be partying during the daytime. You know, it's like, if you're partying in the nighttime, that's normal. But if you're partying in the daytime, it's like, well, how much exactly do you need to party?
What is the difference between a nighttime party and a daytime party in your eyes? Do you go to nighttime parties? Can you describe a nighttime party?
Yeah, I mean, I do go to a lot of parties in the nighttime just about every weekend. To me, the difference between a party at night and a daytime is that for a daytime to happen, you have to know exactly when a house or apartment or whatever is going to be free, and you have to invite a certain number of people, and you try to, you know, you don't want it to get out of hand. Daytimes are pretty hardcore. But I don't know, I mean, you could have all different, you know, like, cliques of people that could have daytime. Like, you could have, like, skater kids or punk kids that have daytime and they go and smoke up or whatever, and then you could have like gangbangers that have daytime, you know, whatever they're doing.
But what type of places do daytimes happen at? Like, well, you said houses and apartments. Would there be any other places that, like, in the backyard or at a park? Because sometimes people here hang out at the park.
Well, during the majority of the school year, it would be way too cold outside for us to be having any kind of gathering in the park. It could be someone's house that the parents aren't home, or it could be like someone's house that maybe like they have an apartment building and one of the apartments, you know, isn't rented or anything, so it's completely empty. There are a lot of coach houses behind apartment buildings. Well, like there's a guy at my school who has nighttime parties. A lot of the time he'll have a party at this house that his parents own and they're like fixing up to sell.
and they must just keep the key, like, on top of the fridge or something, because he can just take it and go into the house whenever they're not there.
How do you guys clean it up, like?
But you have to do a good job of cleanup. The best thing to do is to put it all in one garbage bag and then throw it away in one of your neighbor's garbage cans so that your parents don't see all the booze bottles and when they open up your garbage can.
How popular are daytimes?
Like, I know people from my neighborhood that have daytimes, but that's, I don't think I've ever heard of someone at my school having a daytime. You know, it varies with, depending on where you are and depending on what your high school is like. Like, I think a lot of the people that I know are from selective enrollment high schools, meaning you have to test to get in, so it's not like the people are necessarily more goody-two-shoes, but they are a lot less likely to have daytimes.
Explain a little bit.
Well, the selective enrollment high schools in Chicago were created to try and combat white flight, which is the kids get to high school and the high schools in the area aren't good and the parents either pack up and move to the suburbs or they send their kids to private school or they send their kids to Catholic school because they don't want them going to a subpar public high school if they don't have to. The selective enrollment high schools are a really good opportunity for a lot of people, but I also think that the Chicago public high school system needs to try and maybe fix these neighborhood high schools instead of creating new ones to prevent the parents from leaving.
So why do you go to school? Why do the people around you go to school?
Oh, that is a good question.
It is.
Well, I don't want to say I go to school because I have to, but I know that it's something that's expected of me. There are many, many days where I wake up and I do not feel like going into school, but the friends that I have at school are worth going to see. And I would say that that's pretty true of most other people.
What do you think would make it so that more people would want to go to schools instead of ditching or going to daytimes?
I think that if they just feel like a number, they just feel like they're being looked at by the high school as a security threat, they're not going to feel very bad about ditching or cutting. Because it's just like, well, you know.
Well, what are your attendance policies at your school?
If you miss the entire day, there's an automated recording that calls your house and says, this is, you know, an automated recording from Northside Prep to let you know that your child did not attend school today. Please press 1 to acknowledge that you've received this message. So if you're going to skip the whole day, you either have to have parents that don't care or you have to be home and be the one that gets that call.
Lame.
What did you do the last few times you ditched school?
Usually if I'm ditching school, it's something fairly tame. Once I went out to my car and I waited until my dad left for work and my mom had already left. And then I went back into the house and went to sleep because I hadn't gotten that much sleep left that night. You know, I'm aware that I probably shouldn't be cutting my classes, but I do still get, you know, good grades and I don't really get in a lot of trouble with school anyways. And sometimes you just really want to go get some pancakes instead of going to math class. And I think that's part of high school.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, it is.
Are you planning to go to school tomorrow?
Yes.
Good job.
Thank you.
Alrighty then. Well, I think our time is now done.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So I bid you farewell and good luck with the keeping warm thing.
Alright, bye.
Knock, knock. Who's there?
Voice of Youth.
Voice of Youth who?
Voice of Youth, the daytime show, duh.
Daytime friends and nighttime lovers, hoping no one else discovers where they go, what they do.
That was Nick Bloomberg in an interview that might be a little scary for Chicago parents or any parents to hear.
Hearing an in-depth talk with a kid in another place makes me wonder what concerns are universal for teens. Of course, differences in the weather or an attendance system can influence young people's habits and make them different from place to place. But there must be some universal sense of the purpose of education.
It seems like it's time to get a broader perspective on this education issue.
We went to the other side of the world for this perspective, all the way to Hong Kong, which is in the middle of its Lunar New Year festivities. where Dr. David Post got on the line with us to tell us all about the field of comparative education. Since 2003, he has served as co-editor of the Comparative Education Review, published by the University of Chicago Press, on behalf of the Comparative and International Education Society. Dr. David Post is usually a professor of higher education and of human development and family studies at Pennsylvania State University. But he's traveled to places like Peru and now Hong Kong to learn more about what the different peoples of the world see as a goal of education and the means to that goal.
Next, in these selections from our interview, we're taking you, in time zone terms, 18 hours ahead, all the way to this sprawling Asian city enjoying the first few days in the Year of the Pig.
Hello, David Post.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
First of all, how would you like to be addressed?
Well, I guess you could call me Dr. Post.
Okay.
And who am I talking to?
I'm LaKoya.
Okay, hi, LaKoya.
Hey.
Is that the way you'd like to be addressed?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So, can you just start off by introducing yourself, tell us where you're from, what you're all about?
Okay. I am currently in Hong Kong. I'm on a Fulbright grant. My 15-year-old daughter is going to school here, and my wife's also here. And normally, I teach at Penn State University in Pennsylvania, and I teach about international and comparative education policies, try to understand the reasons for the differences and similarities between the way schools work in different countries. And I have lived and worked abroad for some of my career since 1991. I lived a lot in Mexico and in Peru, and of course in Hong Kong, which is where I am right now.
So we hear it's New Year's over there right now.
Yes. Yeah, we just had the Year of the Pig come in 2 days ago. Last night, we went over to my brother-in-law's house and to watch the fireworks for the Lunar New Year that were over the harbor.
Can you describe, like, what's around you?
Sure. Hong Kong's a very modern city. It's got the best public transportation system in the world, and it's really great for my 15-year-old because instead of being driven places, she can just take it's an octopus card, and she can travel all over the city. It's about probably, you know, at least as big as Sonoma County, and there are trains and buses everywhere, and so she just goes out any place she wants to and travels around, and eventually late at night we call her up and say, please come home now, and she'll come back.
So what does it mean to, like, in your position, what does it mean to have a comparative view on things?
Maybe I should give some examples. In the United States, in high school, quite a lot of students are working in part-time jobs. Now, let me just stop right there. Did you all know, either work in a part-time job, or did you have friends who were working part-time during high school?
Yeah.
That's what I expected, because that's pretty much typical in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so if you didn't look outside the United States, you might think, well, of course, that's just the way things are. I mean, obviously, if you traveled outside the United States, you might be surprised that that's just not the case. It's not really acceptable. People don't do it. It's just something that nobody had ever heard of before. So you've got some extreme cases, like in Hong Kong, where I am right now. I don't know any high school students who work in jobs for money. I don't. I'm not even sure. It's probably not legal, but even if it were legal, I don't think anybody would do it. And although Hong Kong's not a very, very poor city, there's in some ways, it's most kids here don't have as much, you know, money in terms or many material things as kids in the United States. So it can't just be because the kids here are really wealthy. That's not the reason. Now, that's one extreme. But then there are other extremes where kids work even more than in the United States, where they combine work and school all the time. So the United States is somewhat in the middle. There's two things to ask about that. One is why that is. Is it something in the water that people drink in the United States or in Hong Kong that makes them different? You know, I don't think so. I don't think it's the water. What is it that makes it kids interested in working for money more in one country than another? That's one question. And the other is, what happens as a result of that? Are there differences in the kind of education or the kind of experience growing up?
You know, with our show, this week's word or phrase is daytime. It's like when kids cut or ditch school. and it's what they do. It's like when they're just chilling, kicking it, they're calling it the daytime.
Daytime, okay.
Yeah, so I was just going to ask you, is there a lot of that that goes on in those schools over there? Just people cutting, ditching class?
Very little. When the schools, because the kids are constantly studying, they have about, I don't know, about 4 or 5 hours of homework every day.
Wow.
And you know, the parents constantly ask them if they finish their homework. If they finish their homework, maybe they can help one of their brothers or sisters with their homework.
Kids in Hong Kong are, like, required or socially normal to spend so much time on their studies? Or?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And people tend to take, I'd say, a less experiential, or if you want to use the word, a narrower view of education than in the United States. In the United States, we think that many things can be educational. A lot of people in Hong Kong don't see it that way. They think that education is really what happens in schools, and there has, and there's one big reason for that I think is not related to the water, or not related even to the culture of differences, but has to do with the way education structured in these two countries. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you notice, in the United States, we don't have any kind of a national exam that you have to pass in order to graduate from high school, or even in order to go to college. There's just no one national exam. I mean, you could say the SAT or the ACT is some kind of an exam, but it's not an official exam. It's not run by the government.
Well, they've developed the California High School Exit Exam, which you now have to take.
Well, you know, one of the reasons that happened is because California started looking at other countries and started realizing that since we don't have any statewide system of education, instead we have about 1,000 school districts, we need to have some type of an exam. Don't forget that the teachers in California, unlike teachers in many countries, aren't working directly for the state of California, right? They're working for school districts. So even if kids in you know, your district were to start failing that exam, it doesn't mean that the people who wrote the exam in California could just say okay to these teachers, we'll replace you with some other teachers who will teach in a different way. They can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because the teachers are employees of a school district and not of the state, even though the state's developing the exam. Now, mm-hmm. in other countries, it's quite different. Teachers are working, basically, they're government employees. So we have a very different kind of system, almost a non-system in the United States, mm-hmm. as compared to other countries.
So how else do they fund education in different societies?
That's a really good question. In most societies, families pay a lot more money than in the United States in terms of direct costs. For example, one of the things that almost everywhere families have to pay for are the books and supplies that the kids use in school. There's very, very few countries in the world that actually give the kids books to use during the year. Most places, if we're talking about high school, most of the parents pay some type of school fees, registration fees or school improvement fees. Sometimes they don't call them school fees, but the government doesn't give enough money to take care of the school itself. For example, to clean the school or to paint the school. So even though the teacher's salaries may be covered, parents are expected to finance the construction of new classrooms. It has one good side effect, which means that the parents have to pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the schools. They can't just take it for granted that if some kids are marking up the walls of a school, that somebody else is going to come and paint over it. I mean, it's actually the parents would have to come together as a committee and figure out what to do.
I was wondering if you could explain, like, some other factors that contribute to education everywhere.
Well, one of the things I just mentioned is what kids and teachers think the purpose of the school system is. Like, you've been talking about the problems with implementing a California examination,
mm-hmm.
and that seems to be running into problems because there's not really a lot of agreement about whether the purpose of school should even be to pass this examination, and when kids should be expected to pass, and when teachers should be expected to have the kids pass. But in some countries, as I was saying, in the case of Hong Kong, for such a long time, it's just been assumed that the whole purpose of going to school is to pass the exam that you have to take at the end of high school. That changes the way that the teachers teach and the way that students learn, and that's probably one of the reasons why kids are willing to go without some of the things that American teens have in order that they not work in part-time jobs, so they go dedicate themselves full-time to school. There's a lot of agreement in some countries about what the whole goal of education is.
So in other countries, do you know what they view the U.S. as? Like, how do they look at our educational system?
Well, some kids that I've talked to I used to live in Lima, Peru, mm-hmm. and some kids there don't know very much about American schools. Well, that's not too extraordinary. Probably most American kids don't know very much about schools in Peru either. But some kids assume that since the United States is a richer country than Peru is, they just assume that, well, it must be because the schools in the United States work so much better and kids are learning so much more than in Peru. So for some kids, they think that, schools in the United States must be fantastic since the United States is such a rich and powerful country. One thing that Americans take for granted, but which Hong Kongers don't know about and would like to learn more about, is something we call in the United States a comprehensive high school. A comprehensive high school is one that is for everybody. All kids can go there, all different abilities. There's not just one math class, there might be five different math classes, or not just one English class, there might be many different English classes. But now, in many countries, you don't have this type of school. You have different kinds of tracking between schools. Everybody who goes to one high school, takes exactly the same courses. But in order to get into that high school, as opposed to some other high school, you'd have to take some examination.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult to move between high schools. If you were to change levels, you couldn't change levels within 1 year. You'd have to change an entire high school. But I was saying, one good thing about the American schools that people over here would like to imitate is they would like to have less competition. Believe it or not, I mean, in the United States, a lot of teachers and education leaders think that the academics should be more competitive, whereas in Hong Kong, they're trying to get kids to be less competitive and not just focus on the high school exam, but also to expand and do other things, to take part in student government, to take part in arts programs. And
I want to kind of wrap it up and ask you a question about what type of system do you think has provided the best education?
I can't give you a simple answer, but I think that one country has the best education system. I don't believe that's true. I think there's lots of different ways to become an adult and to raise children.
Yeah,
there are many
good ways. Depends on the society that you're into and what you're trying to be as a person.
Yeah,
there are different options in different societies, that's for sure. And I don't think that we in the United States live in any one society. I think there are many different societies all layered right on top of each other.
Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely agree. So we just want to thank you for taking time out your day to talk with us.
LaCoy and Amanda, thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah. Definitely.
That was Dr. David Post speaking to us all the way from Hong Kong, comparing and contrasting the world's education systems. I'm host Amanda Wells.
And I'm host LaCoya Simmons. And we're trying to understand why adults want us to go to school and why we don't want to go a lot of the time.
One thing that caught my attention was how the very purpose of education could be very different for societies. I noticed one thing he said was that the outside world envies the mobility that you can have as a student here in the U.S., but it seems like, in practice, this doesn't really happen. And those kids who are in honors and AP follow that track all the way through high school. So it's like you don't even see the people that are in those other classes, like academic classes, which are basically just college prep, or survey classes, which basically have no homework and are a little bit lower than academic. And then ESL classes, which are for kids who are learning English as a second language.
Speaking of how things work in theory versus practice, we're going to introduce to you someone who knows a lot about how things really go down when kids practice the art of ditching class. Meet Eugene Mijares, a famous figure among Sonoma County youth, and a legend among the students he dealt with in his 18 years as a truant officer for Santa Rosa City Schools. I myself had a few run-ins with this man.
We recently sat down with Eugene to hear some war stories from his time in the trenches, and to get his very informed perspective on why kids are ditching and what could bring them back.
Hello, my name is Eugene Maharis. I'm 22 and counting. I've been a member of the Sonoma County area since 1972. Coming up here to go to college and staying, I was a YMCA director in Sonoma County for 10 years and then went to work for Santa Rosa City Schools, first of all as a campus supervisor and then as a truant officer for 18, and I'm currently employed as a, well, everything but a principal and teacher at a continuation school in Santa Rosa, Lewis Opportunity, for middle school students.
So can you tell us about a day in the life of being a truant officer?
Yeah, I was a truant officer for 18 years, and I was, you know, brokenhearted when they did away with it, not only because of the job, but I helped a lot of kids, and basically a truant officer is operated out of Santa Rosa City Schools. Would come in the morning and pick up the referrals from the school that I was assigned. I had 8 schools, 2 high schools, 2 middle schools, and 4 elementaries. So it was working through the caseload for each day, and that could be from a kid who was refusing to get out of bed in the morning to a student who decided I'm going to go fishing today and not go to school. To the group of kids who would say, I'm not going to school, let's all get to a house and have us a party today, or let's go to the beach. Any reason you can think of that a teenager might come up with for not going to school would occur. So my day was cut out in dealing with those kids who weren't in school, and then looking for kids on the street who weren't in school, and then as concerned citizens would call our office, I would report to different parks to find out why groups of kids were hanging out or not in school. Mm-hmm. And I would question why they weren't in school and either get them to get themselves back in or call a policeman to help me get them to do what they should be willing to do themselves.
So can you give like a story of one day?
If any one day would stand out, it would be more of the hilarious days. That those girls who decided that they were going to run from me today, and they'd run into a apartment complex, and they'd run for about 20 minutes, and I'd just drive away and come back 20 minutes later, and it'd be all sweaty and tired, and are you through running now? Let's get in the car and go to school. I mean, so, you know, I've gone to motel rooms when there's 15 kids in there, and they're drinking, and you know, half a dozen and other things. So, or tell a girl, you know, who's being bombarded by guys trying to take her out, you know, hey, put it aside for a while.
Yeah.
Get your education. That way, when you go to college, you can have your own job, your own money. I saw a girl at McDonald's one day, and she came up to me and goes, you don't remember me, but you told me to put it aside. He goes, Eugene, I'm graduating from that junior college. I got my own car, I got my own apartment, and I'm dating who I want to date. Not who wants to date me,
yeah.
Who I want to date. I'm calling the shots. And there was so much power in that for her,
yeah.
To know that she was in charge.
Definitely.
So do you think having truancy officers like really helps improve the school's attendance?
I think it helps the community. It helps the student, it helps the family, it helps the school. See, if we're not gonna be creating or making taxpayers, we're gonna make tax eaters. That kid who goes to school every day, they're gonna want nice things and they're gonna grow up and earn it and live happily ever after. Those kids who don't finish school, they're gonna want the same things that those other kids wanted. How are they going to get it? Mm-hmm. They're going to steal it. They're going to do something illegal to get it. I mean, I hope not, but you know an education gets you places where a non-education won't get you.
So is being a truant officer like a hard job?
Well, it's kind of like I've told people through the years, people say, how can you stand it? Yeah, because you deal with kids in crisis, kids with problems, kids who are in transition, how can you deal with it? And I would say to them, how does that guy who got to get up on that roof every day in that hot sun and sling a hammer to put that roof on, how does he do that every day? If he can do that, I can do this. To take it off at 5 o'clock. I mean, you deal with a lot of kids in a lot of pain, a lot of problems, a lot of uncomfortable places in life. And if you don't take it off when you leave, it can eat you up. I mean, mm-hmm. I have kids who are on death row, kids who have made it, kids who, you know, ended up crackheads and in and out of prison, murderers, you know, and success. I have social workers and teachers. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So, I know this is kind of a weird question because everybody wants to feel that they ultimately themselves make a difference. But do you feel that you make a difference just by you being you?
I wasn't supposed to make it. I'm from a little community. I was in a gang. I broke the law and was on my way to prison. Mm-hmm. And something inside of me said, hey, you know, you don't need to die this way. You can do something. And because of that, I look back and I tell myself, as far as I'm concerned, is I wanted to have mattered that Eugene Maharis lived and died. And while he was here, he was his brother's keeper, and he tried to help as many kids as he could. When I went back to my hometown after graduating from college, I went to those guys who were in my car club, mm-hmm. and I told them, fellas, I graduated from college.
Your car club is like a gang?
Well, back in the early days, we were lowrider car clubs, and in the mid-60s, they changed the law to where it made too low against the law. And a lot of us were on the border between obeying the law and not obeying the law. So when they came down on us for lowrider car clubs, they forced a lot of us into a gangster lifestyle. We weren't part of them, so it was us and them.
Yeah.
So I went back home and I told them, fellas, I graduated from college. They said, you liar, go get your diploma. You haven't left town. I've been gone in and out for 5 years. And I brought it and they said, now read it to us. They couldn't even read. And they says, what are you going to do, man? Are you going to forget about where you came from? Or are you going to try to help our kids? Well, I didn't help their kids, but I made a commitment to myself to work with teenagers. Mm-hmm. So I've been working with teenagers since I graduated from college.
Wow.
And before that, but I'll share this with you because it's left such an impression on me, is one day I was riding down the street and I pulled alongside of this car where this guy next to me had, you know, full beard and had a full head of hair and tattoos running down his neck. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he goes, hey. And I go, yeah. He goes, are you Eugene Maharis? I said, yeah. He goes, I have much love for you, and drove away. I didn't know who he was, but that made such an impression.
Is there any last shout outs or like anything you want to say to any kids?
Well, I mean, for all those young people who may know me or may have heard about me, or just I hope everybody's well and it's still nice to be working for you, on the job and off the job. Thank you.
Cool.
Thank you.
I shook the hands of men that want me stiff in a hearse. But everything I do is so that one day our kids can see their own kind in a positive way. Although I'm no angel, in God I do trust. I'd like to take a second to tell you about us. Rashid's from Philadelphia. Low G's from Honduras. I was raised with my abuela in a place called Falfurrias. But we're all the same race, and that race is player. I've held 2 jobs, ditch digger and bricklayer. Now I see a sign as I lay in the chalk. Heaven 7 million miles. Lord, don't make me walk.
This is LaKoya Simmons, here in Studio B with Amanda Wells.
And you just got a peek into what it's like day-to-day trying to keep kids on the verge of dropping out from falling off the cliff.
We called up the Santa Rosa City Schools District to get their side of the story. Like, why a position that seemed so important got cut, and what's happened to truancy since then.
We didn't get a response, but some online research confirmed that back in 2003, the Santa Rosa City School District was in the middle of cutting about $20 million from their budgets, and Eugene's truant officer position, actually the last in the county, was eliminated.
But why was Santa Rosa's budget on the block? It ends up going back to the state, how the state's budget was a mess, in many ways due to the energy crisis of Gray Davis's time in office.
This question of who's to blame just gives me a headache.
That's a question with too many angles to look at than we have time for. And it's time for the grand finale of the daytime show.
While Eugene Mijares might be a common name in Sonoma County kids' households, the next person you're going to hear from is a well-known name all around America.
Jonathan Colzel is one of the most prominent critics of the American education system. Colzel is the National Book Award-winning author. His book, the one you can find in every bookstore, Savage Inequalities, detailed the roving rats, falling ceilings, and missing school books that was normal schooling for children from poor families of color in the Bronx.
In the 40 years he's been working on the issue of education inequality, he has achieved a kind of rock star status, selling out venues around the country like Sonoma State University's Person Theater, where I saw him speak in November of 2005. I didn't know about this rock star status, and so when I went to hear him speak about his new book, The Shame of a Nation, with its provocative subheading, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America, I didn't have a ticket, nor did I have an interview set up. I won't give away the end, but let's just say you're going to hear some things no one sitting in the audience heard that night.
Roll the tape.
So, roll call tickets.
Okay.
Come on in.
Sonoma State University, November 11th, 2005, 6:30 p.m. It's already dark.
All right, roll call tickets I'll be taking over here.
Right.
We don't have one as of yet.
No, I don't have one. I have no ticket, no interview. But I have an assignment to listen to and then interview Jonathan Colzel. Quickly, I become unrelenting.
I know, and it's also very important to contact people in advance.
It's something you hear all the time from adults. Plan, don't procrastinate. Do they think one day they're going to win? They're going to be able to hang a banner, mission accomplished, teenagers now thinking ahead?
Well, we could solve the problem if we decided that we needed to.
A guy stands in line, like everyone I interviewed, full of conviction.
There's really two Americas, the children of the wealthy or the privileged or white.
Until the terms need to get defined.
Okay, brown people that are of the middle class.
It all gets kind of awkward when you start asking who exactly is the enemy. Who is the victim? Is it class, race, culture? In our case, the disparity is clear. One line of the haves and one of the have-nots. I even have a need a ticket sign. Finally, some guy sells me one. I enter in triumph and wait. I do not know what exactly I'm waiting for. I don't know that as the lights fall, Colzel is about to raise a curtain on the nightmare worlds that have been the object of his scrutiny.
And it turned out there were 11,000 elementary school children in this neighborhood, 11,000. Of that 11,000, guess how many were white, Caucasian children? 26. That's a segregation rate of 99.8%. 0.2 percentage point now marks the difference between legally enforced apartheid in the South of 50 years ago and socially and economically arranged apartheid in these major cities now.
For an hour, the curtain comes up again and again on scene after scene of shame.
I look into the faces of the children, some of whom in New York and the South Bronx I've known since they were born. If I have the nerve, I look into their eyes. And I usually see them looking into my eyes, too, because you know how little children search the eyes of grown-ups all the time. And I look at that room, and I look at the complexion of the children, and I know their poverty level. And I try to tell myself that this postmodern and millennial apartheid is what Dr. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and all our other martyrs lived and died for.
And for some reason, I can't feel the awe of the others around me.
Virtually all these segregated schools, virtually all these schools are savagely unequal to the schools that serve the mainstream of America.
When I interview him, what am I going to say? I keep thinking. Even when he is wrapping up with one of the most devastating scenes. Kozel describes visiting a school where one teacher had six classes of 40 kids. When a girl told Kozel that she wanted to take an AP class instead of the sewing class she'd been stuck in, a fellow student spoke up.
It's a tough-looking guy named Fortino. He looked like Che Guevara, you know. He looked or like Malcolm X if he were Latino. And he had long, long hair and... his eyes, dark, dark eyes, were loaded with a cynical intelligence. He hadn't said a word. Suddenly he stiffens up and he looks right at her and he says, "Listen to me, Mariah. The owners of the sewing factories need workers, right?" And she says, "I guess they do." And he says, "They're not going to hire their own kids for those jobs, are they?" And one innocent student in the class said, "Why not?" And Mariah said, "So they can grow beyond themselves, but we remain the same."
When the curtain falls on the nightmares, the lights come up. I make sure to be last in line. And when he signs my book, I make my move.
So I'd like to ask you some questions and record them. And
that's all right. You can do it while we walk.
Thank you.
And rushing to keep up with this mysterious figure in a trench coat, smoking a cigarette, I, a white young woman, ask what I can do about these nightmares he's told me about.
Well, one thing students can do is to actually stage a protest. Do you go to a predominantly, an almost exclusively white school?
Yes, pretty much.
One thing people did in the civil rights movement was to organize several hundred students at a school to protest in a peaceful way. A classic form of protest, for example, is to organize a walkout from classes.
We have had walkouts before and everything. Actually done that against racism, but...
Doing it against racism, in my belief, is too vague, because racism is a very big fuzzy word. Can apply to so much. My own belief is that the best kind of protest has a very specific goal. For example, we want our school board, or our principal, or our superintendent, or whoever's in charge, to tell us exactly what he or she is planning to do, so that this will no longer be an apartheid school. And I would use blunt words. If it's virtually no minority kids in the school, then it's an apartheid school. This society can't function if the students won't show up for class. I think students have far more power than they realize. If students insist this and don't just say it once or twice and boycott lunch once a month, but actually refuse to go to class until they are given very concrete promises by the school board, that's a specific goal that can't be dodged. Otherwise, a school system can buy you off by just saying, "All right, we're going to create a student committee on racism."
Yeah. But how are we to break out of this?
By insisting that the almost all white school...
But I mean, there are like a percentage of Latinos at our school. But as my friend was explaining to me, she doesn't like see any of them, like any of the higher classes, just because it's hard for them to like assimilate into that culture because they're so used to like their other culture. And it's more of a culture thing than race more than anything.
I don't agree. If you insisted upon giving every minority kid in your school system 3 years of terrific preschool, which I'll bet a lot of the white kids get, those problems would diminish greatly. They might not go away completely, but they'd diminish greatly. You'd have a lot more children of color coming into kindergarten and first grade at the same level as white kids. And by high school, you'd get a lot of minority kids in honors and AP courses One more question.
So, like, basically, like, what would be a first step? Like,
you know, basically, you should ask this question. What's your school named?
Maria Creo.
Okay, so, you know, the question would be, do people at Maria Creo believe that Dr. King was right? If so, there's something very wrong at our school. Are we going to fix it? What will our school board do to fix it? If not, then what right do we have to celebrate Dr. King's birthday every year? Yes. Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
After, I am done, and I am sitting in some sort of lounge, where Kozel has his back to me, talking with the people who love him so much. All around, people are talking, laughing, and smiling, drinking coffee with plates of snacks. Awkward, I'm just staring. How can they feel easy after what they heard? Are they just so satisfied to know? To know that every object you treasure was stolen for you. In fact, to know that your boat is afloat only because someone stole the planks from another one that's sinking. They would not feel so easy, I think, if, as well as knowing, they felt the other's gaze, sinking, holding us in their gaze as they slip beneath the surface.
That was Jonathan Kozel in 2005, giving me some advice on how to challenge the system of race segregation in America.
Well, we've taken you from Chicago to Hong Kong and brought you right back home, all to explore the term daytime. But now it's time to unbuckle the seatbelts and just bide your time waiting for the next fabulous Voice of Youth show. Same time, same place, on your dial.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Peace out.
This is Jose Chavez, representing the Voice of Youth production staff. We would like to extend thanks to all our anonymous storytellers and phone interviewees who reveal what they really do when they ditch school.
I lit the underwear on fire.
An activity that Nick Bloomberg would probably think called for the question,
how much exactly do you need to party?
To David Post for asking us the question we would never get asked.
Is that the way you'd like to be addressed?
To Eugene Mijares for giving us words to live by.
You don't need to die this way. You can do something.
To editor Katie Stolman for making us sound pro and cutting out this.
Cat.
To Voice of Youth director Tatiana Harrison, who is
very hardcore.
To our production staff, to our fabulous listeners for writing in with their thoughts and praise. Email voy@krcb.org or call 707-584-2017. This is Voice of Youth signing off. Peace out. Keep it real. Oh, I almost forgot. Our thanks to Jonathan Kozel for giving us words powerful enough to end our show on.
We all know we're going to die and lose the ones we love the most to death. And the infinite foolishness of children will outlive us all. My friends, life goes so fast. Use it well.